You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to Who What Wear with Hillary Kerr, your direct line to the designers, stylists, beauty experts, editors, and tastemakers who are shaping the ever-evolving world of fashion. I'm your host, Hillary Kerr, and today I'm speaking with the legendary makeup artist, Patty Dubroff. Patty is so revered in the beauty space, it's almost hard to articulate. She's worked with the biggest supermodels in the world, renowned photographers like Peter Lindbergh and Annie Leibovitz, and beloved actresses including Kate Bosworth, Natalie Portman, and Naomi Watts. Patty's here to talk about her entire career, her favorite beauty tips and tricks, and her must-have products. Plus, we break down her recent work with Priyanka Chopra and Margot Robbie. It's all coming up on Who What Wear. All right, Patty, are you ready for this?
I am ready. Hi, Hillary.
I am so excited to see your beautiful face, not just on my Instagram screen. This is very exciting.
Same, same, same.
So I read that you started doing makeup at the age of 10. Is that true?
Confirm.
So what drew you to makeup? And at what point do you go from I'm 10 and I'm playing with it to, oh, wait, this might be a career?
Well, it's interesting because way back then, we're talking 40-something years ago, it wasn't a known career like it is now. I think if you ask a three-year-old, they know what a makeup artist is now, right?
Yeah.
But back then, it wasn't one of the career options. It wasn't like nurse, teacher, you know, blah, blah. So my mother had this little makeup, you know, mirror and her things. And she wasn't extravagant with it, but she had a few nice things. And I just gravitated to that. And she let me play. And I would paint it on myself, watch her do herself, then like start to do her friends, my friends. Then I was the girl who like everyone went to for the school plays and the dances and the da-da-da-da-da. And I just knew I loved it, but I didn't really know what it meant to make it a job. I just knew I loved it. I remember thinking, I want to be around this when I grow up. So that took me like finishing high school and then getting to New York. And then obviously like department stores had makeup artists. So I went straight there. That was first entry point as a way to like intertwine that thing that I was really into and a way to like pay the bills.
Yeah.
And I was young. I was like straight out of high school. Literally, I graduated and I hightailed it to New York City and I got that job at a counter. And that started setting me up to see all of the opportunities.
So let's talk about that. So I read that you assisted Bobby Brown very early in your career for a fashion show. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about what that show was, what that experience was like. Was it what you imagined, or were you even imagining fashion shows at that point?
I was so green and I have absolutely no idea what the show was. I didn't even know what it meant to be an assistant. I just was told, you know, if you want a portfolio, you've got to assist because that's how you're going to get to the next steps. You know, actually, the very first person I assisted was a woman named Susan Hauser. And she's fantastic. I mean, I was a baby and she was so patient. What a patient teacher. And she took me along with her on some trips to Vegas for some various trade show, fashion show jobs. So that was actually with Susan Hauser, Vegas Fashion Show Trade Show was my very first show. And I do remember that. I don't remember what it was that Bobby did, but it was cool. And I also, you know, very early on assisted Sonia Kashuk. I don't remember what that show was, but, you know, I remember like it was exciting.
So how would you find people to work with and assist? And who were some of your other teachers at that point in time?
Well, I would go to agencies, hair and makeup agencies. And there was some book called Le Book, I think it was called. Do you remember that?
No.
It was like the fashion Bible because, you know, there's no internet.
Yeah.
There's no like Googling makeup artist agents. So there was Le Book. And I looked at who the agencies were and I went. It was a lot of like feet on the ground, hoofing it, knocking on doors.
So I also read that you did a ton of makeup for 90s supermodels like Claudia Schiffer, for example. Can you tell me a little bit about that chapter in your life and what some of the popular beauty looks were that you were creating?
You mentioned Claudia. I actually worked with Christy the most, Turlington.
God.
Yeah, I know. The ultimate goddess.
What a face.
And what a human. And what a heart. So the way that that came about was that was when I actually started assisting Francois Nars. And he was the guy who did every show. It was Versace. It was Prada. It was Calvin. It was Anna Sui. We would do Valentino, you know, like bop, 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 bop.
Like full fashion week.
Full fashion months because it was like we'd go to Milan, we'd go to Paris, we'd go to New York. So there was that. And so being part of that little troupe of, you know, backstage runway gypsies, you all kind of banded together. And those girls were the girls that I would see all day long and then ultimately spend a lot of time with. And Christy became one of my closest friends.
What was the beauty look that you were asked to do the most, would you say, at that era?
I think it was like the epitome of Versace 90s runway show, which was kind of like what we're seeing now in a way. It's like browns and bronzy sculpted with a tight line. You know, the eye is dramatic, but it's in these warm, natural tones. And the face is sculpted, but it's in these warm, natural tones. And then the lip was sculpted to be the most perfect nudie, nudie beige. That was epitome of 90s supermodel.
So at that point, did you feel like you had your own personal aesthetic and point of view, or were you at service to the job, another artist's vision, the photographer? Where were you in your own personal journey?
Yeah, no, I didn't know what my thing was because I wasn't just assisting Francois at shows. That relationship lasted a long time, but I was able to work with other artists on shows in Europe like Linda Cantello and Stefan Murray and Mary Greenwell. And, you know, with Mary, we'd do Vivienne Westwood, you know, one very specific aesthetic. And then with Linda, we would do Tom Ford. And that was a very different aesthetic. I would just do as I was told and try to recreate to the best of my ability. And I was really good at recreating what someone wanted done. So I wasn't figuring out my own thing. That came later, for sure, much later. But it was incredible to see all of these different artists' perspectives and what their thing was so that it could help me hone in on what I really liked, resonated with me, and then adopted as my own. And then also like even seeing like some people's thing, it's like, oh, that's definitely not something that resonates with me. Like I assisted Kevin Aucoin. And I remember one of the very first and maybe only, you know, like I only did it a couple of times because his thing wasn't, I wasn't good at his thing. And he had me sitting in his apartment or in his studio, whatever it was. And I remember being surrounded by false eyelashes and he wanted me to glue, you know, one pair to another pair to make these like stacked lashes. I wasn't good at it. I'm not good at lashes. I mean, that's an, I'm working on that. So you kind of learn like, oh, okay, that's how they do it. But that's not something I'm going to try to do on my own.
Got it. Okay. So in addition, you also worked on music videos, editorial campaigns, ad campaigns. So I'm hoping that maybe you could walk all of us through those different disciplines and what is asked of you as a makeup artist to work on a music video versus an editorial campaign versus an ad campaign.
Oh, wow. There's a lot there. Well, who's guiding the ship? You have to understand like whose information or if there's multiple layers of information, how are you taking that information and translating it? Because I think so much of our job is to listen and then to translate. And if you're not a good listener, you're maybe not going to be a good translator, you know? And if you're not open to what the big goal is, you're not going to be a good translator, which means you're not going to help achieve the goal. So with a, you know, with a musical artist, usually it's them because they have a very specific style and thing. Or it could be the director wanting to break them out of who they were and into another territory. So that's who you're listening to, the director, the artist. Then if you're in the editorial realm, that usually is you're hearing what the magazine wants, you're hearing what the editor wants, you're hearing what the editor-in-chief wants. Maybe you're not hearing it directly, but you're overhearing that. Or the photographer. And then if you're shooting a model, usually that model, maybe these days it's a little different, but you know, back then a model really didn't have any say. But if you're shooting an actress, it's important to make sure they're comfortable in the mix of things. So again, hearing it all, translating it. An ad campaign, who's paying the bills? They're king. Right? So... But, you know, they could hand everything over to the photographer or the art director. And that's where assisting was so incredible for me because I got to be on set with Francois on music videos with Madonna. So I watched how he heard and translated. Editorials with Avedon and Irving Penn. Oh, man. And I heard how, like, the Vogue editor would, you know, explain. And I was just... Taking it all in. And so I got to see how he showed up for and performed in all of these different situations. So that's how I learned how to be in those different situations. I think if I didn't have the opportunity to assist, I would have made mistakes that might have been more detrimental to my furthering of my early career. I made mistakes, for sure, but you know.
Well, you're a human.
Yeah, I had some really good bags of knowledge to bring with me.
So let's talk about the Hollywood piece of it, working with actresses. How did that start? How is it different working with an actor or an actress versus a model? How did you get into that side of your work?
Well, that side started to creep in. I was in New York doing fashion primarily. This is like the late 90s. And I saw a shift starting to happen within the fashion world where I was getting booked with these young actresses for the magazine covers. And the models were slowly not being replaced, but being kind of split, right? So personally, my boyfriend at the time and then became my husband lived in LA and I lived in New York because I did not want to be an LA makeup artist. It was not considered cool. You were cool if you were New York and you were fashion, but if you were Hollywood, you were not cool. And then it really came down to like quality of life and like I didn't want to be on these planes all the time and my husband and I not together. So I decided, all right, since I'm working with these Hollywood people here in New York, let's see what happens there. And I moved, and can I tell you kind of a great story? Because I really believe in signs from the universe. I was making the big move. It was 2001 and I landed at LAX and I'm waiting at the baggage carousel and my agent at the time, there's a message to call him right away. Call him, waiting for my bags. And he says, so you just got booked for the Vanity Fair Hollywood cover. I had never shot a Vanity Fair cover. I think I had maybe done something inside. With Annie Leibovitz, I had never worked with Annie. And it was the Hollywood issue. And it was because of a relationship that I had with one of those actresses who was appearing on the cover. I think it was Jennifer Connelly at the time. And that's how I got that in. And I looked up and went, like, it was a sign, like, I've just arrived and I've got this huge thing and I'm in the right place. I made the right choice.
Oh, that's so incredible. So speaking of Jennifer, you've obviously worked with her for many years. Kirsten Dunst, Angelina Jolie. You worked with Britney Spears, Naomi Watts. Let's talk about the red carpet piece of this, because obviously, as we said, music videos are one thing. Editorials are another. Ad campaigns are their own thing. And then there's red carpet. How does that vary? And what was it like figuring out what worked for the red carpet for you, for your clients, for everyone?
Well, no one taught me the red carpet piece. I didn't assist anyone on a red carpet piece. So that was trial and error. The very first Oscars red carpet that I did was Liv Tyler. And it was 1999. And she was wearing a lavender Prada gown. And I did a pretty makeup. But when I look at it now, I'm like, oh, I could have been a little more red carpet polished. I didn't know. I was doing her as if she was doing an editorial. So it was a learning curve, really, like seeing the result of red carpet images when the wire image pictures would come out, and you would just kind of have your fingers crossed and hope it looked okay. It was really just repetitively looking and going, ooh, ah, that didn't work. Why? Not going to do that again. Or, ooh, that looked really pretty and that worked. Going to make sure I keep doing that. So trial and error.
I would imagine it's very complicated to think about red carpet because unlike an editorial or an ad campaign or a video like where it's a set and a shoot and you know what the light will be like or can test and play with it, you're sending someone out and you don't necessarily know what the light will be on the red carpet, right?
It's all over the place. And you're not just doing the makeup for the red carpet. You're doing the makeup for the entire rest of the night. You're doing her at noon or whatever, and she's out till 2 a.m. That's got to hold up, you know? And there's a lot going on between those 14 hours or whatever. So it's finding the balance between like it looking great in every lighting situation, it performing and holding, and it looking great when they're talking to their friends. That's the other thing. I think that that's where sometimes a misstep can happen. Someone's wanting so bad to make sure that it's going to photograph well, look great on the TV screen, but they're not thinking about that person having to be close with their peers and feel confident and not feel like they have a cake face, unless that's their thing.
I feel like that's somewhat the issue, in my civilian's opinion. The problem with Instagram makeup is like something might look great for an Instagram, but then you see it in real life and they look away.
They look crazy.
Yeah. And it's like often seems like artists don't always take into consideration that other piece of it, which is hugely important to your point. It's like it's not just the performance. It's not just how it looks in photographs, but there's that human IRL component to it where it also has to be great because no one wants to walk around looking like everyone can see where the contour is.
Exactly. I am frustrated with the red carpet photography in general. You know, we all complain about it. It's so uncontrolled. You know, it's the middle of the day. The light, it would look great at one angle, and at another angle, it looked blown out, or at another angle, there's just not enough light or something. You know, like there's just no consistency. So playing it safe down the middle road is usually kind of the way to go because you just don't know.
Right. That makes sense. So wait, can we go back to the Annie Leibovitz Vanity Fair cover?
Sure.
So what is it like working with a photographer like that? Did you learn different things based upon the photographer? I mean, obviously you're translating, you're listening, you're taking lots of information in, but I would imagine since they too are artists, they all work in a different way and there'd be something to learn from all of them. But I'm curious about what your experience was like.
Oh, for sure. You know, every photographer has their own aesthetic. And if the hair and the makeup and the styling and all of the things don't fit their aesthetic, they're going to struggle, right? So like Peter Lindbergh, for example, with Peter, you never cover the skin. And it was a struggle for me because I was coming from like the 90s supermodels who liked to, you know, they didn't like a beat, but they liked a, you know, a flawless. So it was learning how to deconstruct, but still make it beautiful. But the thing with Peter that I really learned, I know you asked about Annie, I'll get there. But with Peter, what I really learned was he did not want it perfect. He's like, no perfect. Don't make it perfect. He wanted that rawness, that realness. And so then it's learning how to like enhance the rawness, realness so that in Peter's world, there is beauty in the shadows and in the texture and all of that. So it's really, yeah, it's really understanding the aesthetic of the particular photographer. And with Annie, things could be a little bit more polished, but you also had to find the balance because she didn't want it to be distracting. You know, some photographers, some of the more current editorial photographers will tell you they don't want a drop of makeup. You're like, but there's this patch of discoloration. There's this pimple. Don't worry, we'll take care of it in post. That's a common thing. And that's tricky because you're there as an artist to do your thing, but you also have to understand that very often what you don't do is where the magic happens. And like the psychology of it all, because you have to make sure the talent still feels beautiful and all of that. And maybe they're going to feel a little naked, but you're going to help them understand that it's going to be beautiful. Don't worry. Lighting does so much, you know?
Lighting is the gift of all gifts, right?
lighting is everything. Oh, it's everything. Everything. That's probably the number one thing I learned early on as Francois's assistant, is where you're doing makeup is just as important as the finished result.
That's an interesting way of putting it that I have not heard before. That makes sense.
He would always like get us out of that, you know, lit makeup mirror to the door, to the window, do it in natural light, because then any room you walk into, any lighting environment you walk into, it's going to look beautiful. And, you know, it's the truth serum. When women do their makeup in like a poorly lit bathroom, they're going to overcompensate for sure. You know, you've got some weird overhead lighting, you're going to pack stuff on because you're going to see all these shadows that maybe aren't really there. They're just light tricks.
So you've also worked with Charlize a lot over the years. We're talking about campaigns, red carpets, and even your first feature film, The Huntsman, Winter's War. Can you tell me a little bit about that project? Because I also feel like that has to be a whole nother layer to all of this.
Well, actually, it wasn't my first feature film. It was my first feature film as a makeup artist. I did a feature film as an actress.
Ah! I didn't know that. Oh.
But my first is a makeup artist. And so Charlize asked me to do that. And I was like, oh, no, I don't do film. It's not my thing. And she actually talked me into it by explaining to me that, especially with that film, we could treat it as if it was a really high fashion editorial, because the character, each outfit, she could have a very extremely different look, and we could play and we could get really creative. That was the carrot that was dangling that drew me in. I was like, oh yeah, okay, I get to be really creative. Yes, yes, yes. And then I was, you know, concerned about the technicalities of a film set, because the whole continuity thing. I didn't really know about continuity. But like she convinced me, and she, you know, she rightly so, like that there were the makeup artists that were there that were, you know, doing the entire film. They would help me. They would teach me. And they were so gracious. And it's a little bit of a tricky position to be in when you're like the celeb request and you're not in the union and you're, you know, you're an outsider. They were so gracious and so sweet. And I got to have a lot of fun and do some crazy stuff with gold leaf and black blood. And
I also have to say, I love the fact that you keep saying yes to new challenges.
Yeah.
And also for such a long period of time, too. It's not a one and done. That is a lengthy process, I would imagine.
Yeah, it wasn't like a 6 month or a 3 month, but it was almost 2 months. And I think that that was the hardest part. It was being away from my family for that extended period of time. And it really made me decide that right now in my life, while my daughter is still at home, which isn't much longer, but, you know, that's not something I want to do. I don't want to be away that long. And maybe down the road in the future, I will revisit, because I loved the camaraderie of the film set. I love the family that's created, this crazy little circus world. I loved a lot of the things, but the time was interesting. And having to say no to other things, that's always a little hard. You're like, oh God, am I going to come back from this film and then no one wants me anymore?
Please, you're Patty. Come on.
Well, I mean, those thoughts never go away, no matter what you've accomplished.
So let's talk a little bit about your process for the red carpet. So I know that it's collaborative because obviously you have your client, there's a stylist, there's hair, there are publicists, there are sometimes creative directors, there are boyfriends, there are children, there's a lot in the mix, there's the designer, there's a lot of energy going into it. So in a perfect situation for you, how does that process work? Like, you obviously have teams that you work with frequently and you seem to have wonderfully collaborative processes. But I'm curious, is it like the dress happens first and then the hair and makeup? Is it ever you're like, okay, I want to do this kind of makeup, but hair wants to do something different? How do you negotiate that seamless, correct head-to-toe look?
Well, you hope that as soon as the dress has been decided upon or is being considered, that you're brought into the mix in an ideal world. I mean, if you know the client. If you don't know the client, then the first thing is a deep dive into that person's red carpet history, editorial history. Red carpet is kind of more important to do the research on because, you know, you see real stuff versus editorial can be very manipulated. You know, first it's the person and feeling like you kind of understand what works for the person, what doesn't work for the person. Then the dress. The dress is going to give you most of the cues you need, but the other cues you need to take into consideration are, what is the event? If it's the Met Gala, what's the theme? and then start researching what that theme is so that it has a synergy. If it's a red carpet with a cocktail, it's less pressure than if it's the Oscars or the Globes or whatever. Or like a premiere in Rome has a very different flavor than a royal premiere in London. So having an understanding of the where is so important. What is it going to feel like in that room or in that space? Imagining yourself there. And then once the dress is decided upon, I'll always like see a dress and I'll think the first thing that hits me is, oh, that has to be a red lip or whatever. But you never want to have your focus too narrow. So it's like, okay, well then what else can it be? And I try to put together mood boards of what I think makeup would complement that dress and that person. Of course, it's nice to know the jewelry too, because then if the jewelry has a color in it and it's so close to the face, you want to make sure that there's a synergy there. And all of these texts are going on, like usually, hopefully with the team, you know, so the stylist and the hairdresser and the actress, if you have that kind of a personal relationship. And then, you know, if the hairdresser's feeling like they're wanting to make a big statement, maybe you're going to go like, oh yeah, I probably need to pull back. If they're going to slick all the hair straight off of her face, you maybe don't want a big red lip, you know, depending on the person. But, you know, you have to really think about the balance and everything. So it's being prepared and trying to like kind of get everyone on the same page as much as possible. But then it's being open to whatever happens at the last minute. And a lot can happen at the last minute. A dress can be changed at the last minute. And it's happened. It happened for me for a really big red carpet. We were sure that it was this dress. And then on that day, I arrive and it's like, oh, and she's not wearing that. She's going to wear this. And it was a dress I'd never seen before. And it was like, I remember I actually got kind of upset. And I was like, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't anybody tell me? And the stylist was like, I didn't know until right now. I'm sorry. And thank God I had my full kit with me and I thought on my feet and came up with something and I had something. If I would have been so sure that it was only that and only brought the little baby kit for that, I would have been in trouble. The other thing is thinking about who's the designer of the dress, making sure that you're going to fit the aesthetic of that designer if they have a very strong aesthetic and you want to make sure that they're also happy. So there are a lot of things to think about. And I think that people don't realize that. They think she just showed up like that on that carpet.
No, we've been thinking about strategy.
This for months. Yeah, months.
Okay, so you have worked with Priyanka Chopra and Margot Robbie for years now, and they have countless incredibly stunning looks that you've done on both of them. So I'm hoping we can run through a couple of those and you can talk a little bit about how things came together. Okay, so for Priyanka, let's talk about the camp-themed Met Gala. She's wearing silver, Dior. There was a lot of silver accents. You did sort of a plum berry lip. How did that look come together?
That was a crazy one. I was like looking at those images again and I'm like, whoa, I kind of went for it there. And oh, whoa. Well, the theme. Okay. First of all, it's camp, right?
Yeah.
So that's like anything goes. The vibe of that dress, there was a nod to the royal courts of past. And, you know, like Marie Antoinette reference was thrown into the mix. And I was looking at these old Dior Galliano runway shows where he had them powdered white faces, you know, very court-like and big hair. So there was some of that brought into the mix. I did these like Swarovski crystals. And as a beauty mark, because I had learned in my research of that period that the placement of the beauty mark was very important for sending a message to others. So I loved those subtle cues and using the Swarovski crystal, which there was crystals all over the dress. So we tied those in. We did one and then we did another. And then we thought, let's put one in the center, like a bindi, speaking to her heritage. So there was that. It was actually, that was one of the trickier red carpets for me because I didn't know what the dress was going to look like until pretty late in the game. And it was one of those where nobody really knew what they wanted to do until we got into the room. And then we just kind of like, we're like, ah, all right, let's really do this. We did a few trials and it was still like nervous a little bit. Yeah, that one was tricky. That one was a lot.
Can we talk about her beauty look for the royal wedding?
Oh, yeah, that was so beautiful.
The purples really popped. How did you make that happen?
It's all layering. You know, it's layering like a sheer cream shadow with a very highly pigmented, brighter shadow. Like usually I'll do something that has a little more depth as a cream, as a base to help it, you know, frame the eye or sculpt the eye and then pop the vividness on top. So the vividness has some depth underneath it, but it has something to kind of bounce off of. So technically that's how. And then the outfit she was wearing was in this like kind of gray lavender feeling. Also, it was so beautiful being in Windsor at that time. The flowers were all in bloom. Like I kept hearing in my head, purple rain, and, you know, because purple rain, you know, yeah. And the that color purple epitomizes royalty. And there were flowers in bloom all over the property in those tones. So that's where that came from. And I made this mood board. You know, sometimes I'll just like spend a lot of time in a mood board, you know, and trying to like piece it together that way. You know, a mood board's so great because it helps you express yourself through imagery, which in makeup, it's hard to express yourself often through words because everyone has a different connotation. So yeah, mood board really kind of helped lead into let's purple rain it out.
I'd also like to talk about Margot's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood tour. That whole run was incredible. It was funny because when we were prepping for this, like there are too many looks that we wanted to talk about because there's so many incredible beauty looks from that entire season. But I think the one I'd like to talk about, if you're willing, is the sort of peachy orange smoky eye when she was wearing that Oscar de la Renta gown. And I feel like that ended up influencing a lot of the sunset eyes that we saw that whole summer. And I'm wondering how that came together or if you have a look from that time period that you really loved in particular.
No, oh, thank you so much. That Oscar de la Renta of the whole tour was for me probably my favorite. That was London. So we were on a press tour for that. So I had to pack moderately. I didn't want to lug 100 pounds of makeup, but, you know, I want to make sure I'm prepared. So there was a through line of the entire press tour where Kate Young, the incredible stylist, always had this like a hint of orange, dusty greens, and the poster, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood poster, had those tones in them. It was kind of this incredible like sunset vibe. And so that was my wheelhouse, was this red, orange, orange into yellow color palette. And I worked in that color palette for the entire tour. And then for that red carpet, that incredible orange Oscar de la Renta, I did like an orange across the lid and then in the corner, it was purple. Did you catch that?
Yes.
So it was kind of like an ombre thing. And I love orange and purple together. And I loved that the purple kind of gave the corner some depth. It gave it a good color contrast. And the vividness of the eye was also kind of grounded, you know, with the purple at the corner. And I mean, that was stunning. That was probably one of my favorite red carpets ever, ever.
So wait, can we talk about the Oscars and this award season in general? Can you walk me through that look from ideation to execution?
This year's Oscars?
Yes, because her skin was like otherworldly.
Her skin is otherworldly, that's for sure. I mean, but she's still a human, but she's got real good skin. So, you know, when there's really good skin to play with, you know, you don't have to do much to make it look good. Okay, that look, I haven't told anyone this. All right, I'm going to tell you this. We had another direction that we were going. It was stronger and not more of a look because what she had was a look, but it was a different direction. And that was kind of what we thought we were doing. And we did a test run over the weekend, thank God. And it's rare that you have the opportunity to do test runs, but you know, we all thought it would be a good idea just so that it would be chill on the day. You know exactly what you're doing going into it. It saves all the nerves. And so we did the test run and then kind of thought, maybe that's not the right direction. So we thought about it a lot and kind of came back to this thing about purity and simplicity. And Margot's beautiful skin is tan at the moment. You know, so I really just kept thinking like, I want to heighten that tan, make her just look like a living, breathing ray of sunshine, you know, sun-kissed, healthy, healthy, healthy. And she is really healthy right now. Her skin's bronze. So when I was looking at images of her, when the other idea went away, you know, I went on Margot Robbie and I'm looking at a lot of it. I did pretty much most of it. And it was like these editorials where, you know, it was outside and natural makeup or like events that were chill where it was like supernatural. And those were the ones I kept like screenshotting. And it turned out it was like, absolutely less is more. It doesn't have to be just because it's the Oscars and she's wearing, you know, a Chanel couture gown and whatever. You don't have to pile on the lashes and the gloss. You know, you can have this incredible sense of purity and it be elevated and important. And that's where we landed.
I love that. It's also so interesting too, like how much of a work in progress it is. Like there's also like a fundamental creativity and humility and being able to say like, let's try this, let's try this. And I think that mindset for an artist at your level to still have that, to embrace that is so refreshing to hear and so lovely to hear. And it is inspiring to hear because I think like people have this idea of like someone of your talent, it's this way or that way. And the fact that you still play very clearly is just a delight to hear.
You know, you listen to others and you have to set your ego aside. And like, I'm a stubborn ass Taurus. I am like, if I decide that this is what it's going to be, it takes a lot to budge me. And then I have to like really remember. And I probably have lost clients in the past because of that stubbornness. It's your work too. But here's the reality. You're not the one who's going to be scrutinized by the entire world. So I'm not the one who has to get on in that dress and on that carpet and in front of all those cameras and feel like a million bucks. I don't want to put my stamp on it that hard that that person is potentially like feeling a little unsure. We are just there to fully wrap them in self-confidence.
Okay, so our audience is very interested in your beauty takes, your tips, your advice. So I'm hoping that you can share some wisdom for the listeners at home. Any simple makeup application tips? Are you a brush lady? Do you like sponges? Are fingers the way to go? What are some of your like easy go-to tips for someone who is not a professional?
Okay, well, first of all, I mean, do what you feel comfortable. If you feel comfortable using your fingers on yourself, by all means, do it. You know, like if that's your comfort zone. If you're going to use a sponge or a brush, keep them clean, please, because they are bacteria parties waiting to happen. And I really like to finger paint. You know, I like to smush the lipstick in with my finger. COVID has, you know, changed some of those practices. So I've really had to reevaluate a little bit and, you know, also how I like would like to like put makeup on the back of my hand and use that as a palette. I've had to change that a little bit, but I've discovered these other really cool things that help make my job easier, like this acrylic palette plate from the Artist Kit Company. I can like put all the makeup on that. So my hands are clean. I'm not getting my makeup all over myself and whatever. It's more sanitary. And it's so cool because I can also hold it up to someone and check to see if the color, at least the skin colors or whatever, are going to work on their skin. So that's a tip. I mean, that's more, maybe that's for the makeup artists out there. For application stuff, when I'm applying foundation, I do use a combination of all the things. A brush first, a sponge at a point to press and blend, and then my finger. There's nothing better than your finger to make sure that the warmth of your finger is kind of like warming up the product. Another big thing is I don't pack on a lot of powders. I often don't even use powder on someone or on myself. Powder's really aging.
No baking for you?
I bake. Well, no, actually, I don't even bake. My daughter bakes and I've got the hips to prove it. But no, I wouldn't know how to do that. And I think it would just hurt me deeply to see that in real life. But it is some people's aesthetic and that is what makes them feel good and confident. So who am I to say, you know, like the people who like the vibe that I give off, which is like a fresher, more naturalistic approach, they're the ones who are going to seek me out. The ones who like a full beat, they're going elsewhere and there's room for everybody.
There is room for everyone. I love that. So My like dream and horror is to walk down the street with someone like you, a professional makeup artist, and ask them like, what does your eye see that people are doing wrong in real life? I think it would be fascinating. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you see out and about in real life that is a common mistake that just kills you a little bit, or something that could be corrected easily.
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is like when that heavy contour thing was a thing, and I would see people in real life out of their little like Instagram, YouTube boxes and see them like with all that stuff on their face. That hurt a lot. And it was distracting in a way. I'm more attracted to the things that are like cool and unique and really like feel like they belong to the person. You know, maybe there's like an unfortunate color matching of foundation that might be evident, but I don't go around offering my opinion. I love to see people fully embrace their thing, no matter what it is. If it's, you know, a neon color blocked eye or not a stitch of makeup. Chloe Zhao was amazing on the red carpet. She didn't have on a stitch of makeup. My daughter came in and the TV was on and my daughter was like, she has on no makeup. She is a queen.
It's true.
It is so true. So like, what's your thing? Embrace your thing. Feel confident in your thing. And don't feel like you need to like fit in someone else's box.
So could you give me maybe two or three products that you think everyone should have in their kits? Some universal crowd pleasers.
Well, a lash curler.
That's number one?
That's the first thing I thought of. I saw my lash curler. But no, actually, yeah. It's like if I'm not doing any makeup at all, I'll curl my lashes. It makes a difference.
Okay, so lash curler.
Lash curler. A high quality either concealer or foundation or a hybrid, just to even up a little bit. Like it doesn't have to be a complicated foundation routine, but something that is going to help you even out your skin a little bit. It will make a difference because if the skin is uneven and discolored or whatever, it's hard to like get the pop of a beautiful lipstick or, you know, to see the eye because it's broader zone. You want to even that out. So that would be very important. I don't know. I think everyone should have like an incredible red lipstick that makes them feel good. And there's so many different skin tones and there's so many different shades of reds and textures of reds. So whether it be something very sheer and balmy and like a tinted lip balm that hues into the red or a full body rich velvet red lipstick. I think that's like a good thing to have. And then a blush. Blush is important. A great cream blush. It's going to make a big difference. But you can always use your lipstick as your blush too. So then maybe it gives me room to do one more. And I would say like, make sure your brows are in good shape, whether that means filled in or whether that means you don't necessarily need to pluck them, but just make sure that they're in decent shape. There's no crazy hairs sticking out wildly, like my husband, who won't let me touch his.
And we love him for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so last question. You have 5 minutes to get ready in the morning, Patty. What are you doing?
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm probably going to open up my freezer and take out some kind of a cold roller ball, and I'm going to try to take the puffiness around my eye away, and then I'm going to put on my favorite lip balm. It's Chanel Hydra Beauty, and then I'm going to make sure I have on some moisturizer, and that's probably going to be like either Augustinus Botter, or I've got some Skin Food Weleda, or I have this beautiful Chanel moisturizer. I'm going to put on some moisturizer, put on my lip balm, and then I'm going to put on a coat of Black Le Volume mascara after I curl my lashes, and then that's 5 minutes. So I've taken the puffiness away. I've hydrated my face and my lips, got a good coat of lashes opening up my eye, and then I can rush out the door.
I have to say mascara is my desert island product. So when you find your perfect mascara, and by the way, I have several because they have different reasons, you know, like mascara, nighttime mascara, you know, depending on what's going on.
Underlash mascara, corner mascara.
But I am with you. If there's one thing that I'm really going for, it's mascara.
Yeah, me too. And for me, like finding a good mascara means one that it has to like kind of fit on your face. Like, you may say your favorite mascara is blah, and I'd be like, oh, but when I wear it, it flakes. Or when I wear it, it smudges. And you're like, oh, that never happens to me.
It's very personal.
It's very personal. The formula, the brush, all of that. For me, the La Volume is like holy grail mascara.
I'm going to have to try that. I'm literally going to go shop that right now.
It's so good. And there's a brown one. It's kind of, oh, it's so pretty. It's like kind of a bronzy metallic.
Ooh.
La Volume. I love that so much when I want like a softer eye or for the bottom lashes. Yeah.
Okay. Excellent tip. Thank you, Patty. And thank you so much for your time. This was such a pleasure on so many levels. I love interviewing you. It's really like highlight of my career always. So thank you for your time. I know our audience is going to be really, really excited.
Thank you. Thank you. And I can't wait to see you in real life at some fabulous event. I can't wait to be uncomfortable in high heels again.
A huge thank you to my guest today, Patty Dubroff. Make sure to subscribe to our show wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss an episode. And while you're there, I would be so grateful if you would rate and review us. If you have any guest suggestions or any other feedback, drop us a line at podcast@whowhatwhere.com, or you can find us on social at @whowhatwhere. See you next Wednesday on Who What Where with Hillary Kerr. This episode was produced by Hillary Kerr and Olivia Capoletti. Editing is by Natalie Thurman and Treehouse Recording in Los Angeles, California. Our music is by Jonathan Leahy.